Earth date, November 22, AD 2517. Location, open space. Galactic position, outside solar system A361. Astronomic location, Bodis Galaxy. With the lights dimmed, Yamashiro and a few of his officers studied every detail as the holographic image played over the conference table. It showed the destruction of the Kyoto. For some reason, the satellite monitoring the Kyoto had captured the destruction more clearly than the satellites covering the other ships. Not that it made much of a difference. Whatever happened to the three battleships had happened in an instant. Yamashiro's analysts had searched the transmission for lasers, particle beams, and other rays. Nothing. They found no distortions around the ship in the moments before the attack. There were no signs of missiles, rockets, or enemy ships. Yamashiro paused the feed. The analysts had added a red arrow to the display to mark the mass that they claimed was the wreckage of the ship. The arrow pointed at an unidentifiable wad of material that looked like a glob of soft wax. Measurements appeared along the bottom of the image. The unidentifiable wad was 336 feet long and 56 feet wide. The measurements were about one-tenth the size of the battleship the wad had supposedly replaced. Intelligence analysts said that properly compressed, the Kyoto could fit into an even smaller space.
This is all that is left of the ship.
The other officers remained silent for several seconds. Captain Takahashi broke the silence.
That cannot be. It happened so fast. It's too small to be the Kyoto.
You need to read Hara's report. He explains it.
Lieutenant Tatsuhara, a computer simulation specialist and intelligence officer, ran the Sakura's pachinko parlors, bars, and casinos. Every sailor on the ship knew him.
Hara says that the right amount of heat applied inside the hull, maybe 10,000 degrees, would cause a battleship to melt and implode.
10,000 degrees inside the ship? How do you heat the inside of a ship? It's impossible.
Master Chief Corey Oliver showed no emotion as he watched the feed. Sitting beside him, Chief Petty Officer Brad Warren followed his lead.
May I have permission to speak candidly, Admiral?
Speak.
I don't see how this changes anything.
You lost 3/4 of your men. You had 12,000 seers. Now you have 3,000. I commanded a fleet. Now I have one ship, and you have only 3,000 seers.
3,000 men, 12,000 men. We never had enough men to capture a planet. This was a suicide mission from the start. At least it was for us. I still have enough men to accomplish my objectives.
What are your objectives?
The SEALs came to make sure the aliens never attack Earth again.
Can you do that with 3,000 men?
We could do it with 300 men, sir. We just couldn't do it with conventional tactics.
Master Chief, we came here to protect Earth, not to commit suicide.
The SEAL spread his hands on the conference table, and Yamashiro studied his long fingers with their sharp, claw-like tips. They looked like human fingers somehow merged with an eagle's talons.
With all due respect, Captain, we can't protect Earth and ourselves at the same time. I am not privy to your orders, Admiral, but they can't possibly have included capturing the planet.
Ships are not used for capturing planets.
Neither are SEALs. We're the fifth column. The SEALs are the men hiding inside the Trojan horse. We creep inside the walls and open the gate for an invading force. We don't take the town ourselves. That falls to the Marines.
There are no Marines. Not on this mission.
Yamashiro turned to glare at Takahashi. Just for a moment, he felt ashamed of the boy. The Admiral's gaze strayed to Senior Chief Warren, sitting silently, allowing his superior to speak as the lone voice. He admired Warren. He admired Oliver. Then he thought about his son-in-law, who had left his wife and children to fly this mission. Yamashiro recognized Takahashi's sacrifices, and his irritation eased.
What do you suggest? Master Chief?
Admiral, we have lost 3/4 of our fleet. We no longer have the firepower we need to carry out our mission. We must return to Earth. We must report that we have located the aliens and request a larger fleet and more troops. As the Master Chief has suggested, we should have our SEALs open the way, then send in Marines.
Oliver did not speak.
What do you think we should do, Master Chief?
Maybe we should return to Earth.
We should return?
We should return and report what we have found. If we attack now and we fail, everything we have learned will be lost. If the Linear Committee sends another fleet after us, that fleet will be forced to begin the search all over again unless you report our findings. We should return to Earth, but not for Marines. We need to make our report, then launch our attack. We're not here to defeat this enemy. We need to destroy them.
Yamashiro listened to the SEAL explain his case and realized something about himself. He didn't want to go back to Earth, not empty-handed. Forced to choose between carrying out a kamikaze mission and returning to Earth for more ships, he preferred the kamikaze mission. After the meeting ended, Master Chief Oliver remained standing beside the conference table as Takahashi escaped like an alley cat running from a fight.
Admiral, sir, this SEAL wishes permission to speak.
What is it, Master Chief?
We fired weapons at two moons, is that correct? We fired infiltration pods at the moons.
That is correct.
As I understand it, only one of the moons was destroyed. Is that correct?
What is your point, Master Chief?
One of the moons had an atmosphere. The other did not.
Do you want to see the video feed?
No, sir. Admiral, it seems like the aliens' technology only works when there is an atmosphere present. There was no atmosphere on the smaller moon, and the aliens were not able to prevent our attack. The large moon had an atmosphere, and the aliens destroyed our pods.
What about the battleships?
Our battleships have atmospheres, sir.
Yes, they do.
Admiral, that might explain why the aliens did not attack our transports. The pilots purged the oxygen out of our transports.
Listening to the SEAL fascinated Yamashiro. He was a clone. He had the face of a monster. No, a demon. The nickname Kage no Yasha ran through the Admiral's mind, and he dismissed it. For the first time, Yamashiro looked past the low, bony brow and saw only admirable qualities. Location: Gobi. Galactic position: Perseus Arm. Astronomic location: Milky Way. The last census reported the population of Gobi at nearly 1 million, but that was before the Avatari invaded the planet. At the time of the evacuation, slightly less than a 500,000 people resided on Gobi, most of them living in concentrated clusters. We only needed 2 barges to evacuate the planet. While I was off hijacking barges, Admiral Jolly sent a clutch of senior officers to oversee the evacuation. By the time I arrived on the scene, they had nearly completed their work. I flew to Morrowtown, the largest city on the planet, population 53,000. Not much of a city. One of Jolly's officers, a Captain James Holman, ran the operation with ruthless efficiency. He lifted the people out first, allowing them no more luggage than a change of clothes. That part of the lift took approximately 8 hours. Once he had the people out, he sent teams of scavengers to look for food, medical supplies, and other essentials. Holman had thought of something I had overlooked. Before the month was out, we would have millions of refugees to house and to feed. We would need more than food and water. When they became sick, they would look to us for medicine, clothing, soap, shelter, bedding, building supplies, everything. Morrowtown was a 2- and 3-story burg composed of sandstone-colored buildings. Its streets were dirty and empty. The capital had faded into a ghost town. Admiral Jolly flew in from the Perseus Arm to accompany me during my inspection. He must have mistaken me for a real officer. He saluted.
We have 3 hours until things start heating up. We need everyone off the planet by 1800.
Where did you get that information?
Anonymous tip.
You want to share your source?
No, Admiral, I don't.
Before I left Gobi, I would relieve Jolly of command. He was weak and pondering.
I told Holman not to leave until he packs every iota of food and medical supplies on the planet.
He's got 3 hours.
That sounds suspiciously like an order.
Not at all, Admiral. I'm not the one calling the shots. In 3 hours, the atmosphere will ignite, and everything on the planet will burn. The food will burn, the men looking for the food will burn. The Avatari are the ones controlling the clock.
Using an old farm truck commandeered by his men, Admiral Jolly and I began our inspection. Jolly and I sat in the back. We passed dozens of abandoned vehicles parked along the streets. People had left their hopes and possessions behind. I couldn't judge their hopes, but their possessions had been pretty meager.
I noticed something interesting. The doors of the houses were closed, and many people left their cars parked and locked as if the occupants expected to return home to them. As we passed one building, a dog watched us from behind a window. We drove around a corner, and I saw something out of place.
Stop!
I climbed out to take a closer look. I saw a double long freight truck, a real blue whale compared to the small antiquated vehicles you normally saw in Morrowtown. It sat unmoving, sprawled across the road. The truck had jackknifed. Its enormous cargo trailer had slid out of control and crashed into the side of a building. As I walked around the front of the cab, I saw that the hood had crumpled during the collision.
What happened here?
Jolly came up beside me, the Master Chief Petty Officer following behind him. Looking over the scene, I wondered how recently the attack had occurred. A string of bullet holes decorated the driver's side door. I had a particle beam pistol tucked in my belt. It wasn't much of a weapon at long range, but at least I came armed.
We need to get MPs out here!
Shh.
We need help!
A dead sailor lay sprawled on the hood of the truck. He was covered with blood. By the way the driver sat slumped against the steering wheel, I could tell that he had not had time to reach for his gun, assuming he had one. One of his hands was still on the wheel.
Damn.
Do you think they're dead?
The question is how long they've been dead.
Like Admiral Jolly, our driver had come unarmed. It wouldn't have mattered if he had brought a gun. The looters shot him before he could have used it. With Jolly crowding me the way he was, I hadn't noticed a door opening across the street. 5 men had emerged. They had spotted us and opened fire. I pushed the Admiral out of my way and dived to the ground. Jolly's hands were waving in the air, and the pack instinctively knew he posed no danger. 3 of them toted boxes, while 2 carried guns. But as the shooting began, the 3 with the boxes tossed the goods aside and produced M27s. Bullets flew wide and high, but nothing came close to hitting me. I don't know if they spotted Admiral Jolly as he crab-walked to a dumpster. Not worrying about ammunition, the looters advanced toward me. Aiming my pistol between the truck's 2 front tires, I hit the first man in the leg. These men liked shooting unarmed sailors and men they caught unawares, but they weren't prepared for me to return fire. As they stood gaping at their injured friend, I rolled out from under the truck and shot one in the face. One of the remaining looters tried to hold his ground, pointing his gun in my general vicinity. The other 2 cut and ran. I nailed the shooter first, hitting him in the right shoulder. I hit the first of the 2 runners in the ass as he dashed up the street. The last of the looters ran like a gazelle. Still not looking back, he pitched his rifle over his shoulder and continued running. He had a head start, but he also had a gut, and I gained ground on him quickly. Still running, I reached out, grabbed the bastard by the collar, and pulled back as hard as I could.
Don't shoot! Please, for God's sake, don't shoot!
Fat old Admiral Jolly came waddling out of his hiding hole.
Kill that man! Shoot him!
Any last words?
I didn't do it! I didn't shoot at you! It wasn't me! It was Todd! The whole thing was Todd's idea!
Kill him!
Todd's idea? Todd's idea? Oh, God, don't shoot me! I didn't know he was gonna kill anybody! Look, we got all kinds of stuff. I promise, I'll give you half of everything! No, all of it! All of it, I'm good for it!
Sounds like you've got the golden goose. Maybe I should let you go.
We could be partners. Don't shoot me.
How do I know you aren't going to keep it all?
I'll bring it. I promise we can split it 50-50.
I don't trust you.
I swear!
Kill him, Harris! Well, that's an order!
Don't kill me, please! Don't kill me!
How do I know I can trust you?
Ask anyone. I'm honest. I'm good for it.
I'd ask your friends, but they're all dead. Everyone else is gone.
I backed up and let him get up.
We meet right here, day after tomorrow. If you're not here with enough swag to fill a transport, you're a dead man. You hear me?
Yeah. You're gonna be a rich man.
I can still shoot you. Tomorrow, next week. You got that?
Oh, you won't be sorry. You won't. You're gonna be rich.
Get out of here.
Why did you let him go?
Didn't you hear? He's going to make me rich.
You're never going to see him again.
Damn straight I'm not going to see him again. Why the spec do you think we evacuated this planet?
In 3 hours, the city's going to be dust. And that bastard is going to be dust along with it.
I told you to kill him. I ordered you to kill him. You disobeyed a direct order.
I ignored his rant and walked past him. Yeah. I knelt and picked up the M27 to examine it.
We need to talk about that. Admiral, I'm relieving you of command.
You're what?
I'm relieving you of command. These are dire times, Admiral, and you're not fit for command.
I'm what?
Not fit for command. I'm telling you to step down.
To what?
To retire. Go set up a villa by the beach. Go spend time with your grandkids.
Who the hell do you think you're speaking to?
Admiral Stephen R. Jolly, enlisted man's navy, retired.
And who do you think will take my place?
Probably Admiral Leota. Maybe Wallace. I haven't decided.
Do you honestly believe Warhawk Wallace is fit for command?
Nope. It really doesn't matter. If Wallace isn't any better than you, I'll retire him.
You can't do this!
This wasn't the first time I had killed a superior officer. And judging by the men lined up to replace Stephen Jolly, it wouldn't be the last time either. As the last of our transports left the planet, I received a message from Captain James Holman inviting me to the Bolivar's observation deck. I had never met Holman in person, but I liked the way he evacuated Gobi. As I had already rifled through one-third of my top leadership prospects, I made a mental note to watch Holman as a possible alternative once I ran out of one stars. I went to the observation deck, and there was Holman, who might have been the oddest-looking clone in history. When I first saw him, I even mistook him for a natural-born. Older clones were known to dye their hair blonde, but Holman, a man in his early 30s, had dyed his hair a coppery version of fire engine red. He also had a beard. I had seen clones with whiskers, but a beard? Like his hair, the beard was that same unnatural color of red.
Hello.
You put together a good operation.
Not good enough. I understand they were looters.
You can bring a horse to water.
But they shot Admiral Jolly. This is a blow to the enlisted man's empire.
Not as much a blow as you might think. I understand he planned to retire right after the evacuation.
He never told me.
Yes, well, Admiral Jolly kept his plans pretty quiet. With that, we sat and we waited.
Death arrived on Gobi 6 hours late. This had happened before. The virtual ghost of Arthur Breeze tended to err on the safe side with his predictions. At 0317 STC time, the Avatari ignited the tachyon D particles they had pumped into the atmosphere, and the temperature instantaneously spiked to 9,000 degrees. Unable to see the destruction through the viewport, Holman and I switched to a computer display. The first thing we saw was the destruction of Gobi Station. Several of the smaller structures around the base exploded. The base itself, a tall spindle-like building armed with cannons and radars and landing pads, seemed untouched by the heat for 20 seconds. Laser cannons exploded, launch pads melted, but the base remained erect. The heat continued for precisely 83 seconds. During that time, the sand around Gobi Station turned orange and melted into a shallow ocean of glass. Outcroppings of rock exploded. The superheating of the planet caused the atmosphere to rise in its own convection. As it rose, the atmospheric pressure lifted with it, and Gobi Station burst like a balloon. The inner framework remained, but the outer walls blew off the building, leaving the inner structure to wilt in the extreme heat. When the 83-second attack ended, the atmosphere cooled and fell back into place, crushing the remains of Gobi Station into a twisted pile of girders. I thought about the looter I had allowed to escape. He'd probably died in the first second of the attack. One moment he'd have been looking at whatever swag he'd accumulated, and the next moment he was dust. At least he died happy. After all, he'd outwitted a dumb Marine. Earth date, November 23, AD 2517. Location, New Copenhagen. Galactic position, Orion Arm. Astronomic location, Milky Way. The Japanese fleet had begun its mission in 2514, right after the aliens were turned back on New Copenhagen. At the time they embarked,
it looked like the war for the Milky Way had ended and the Unified Authority had won. Yamashiro Yoshi recognized the decrepit state of the Unified Authority and saw it as dangerous. The Unified Authority was an empire in collapse. One more attack, be it from renegades like the Morgan Atkins believers or aliens, and the empire would fall. It was teetering that close to the edge. But an empire teetering on the brink of extinction is also an empire on the alert. Fearing that the UA Navy might start shooting before the crew of the Sakura could identify themselves, Yamashiro decided it would be safer to begin the journey to Earth by stopping by its nearest populated neighbor, New Copenhagen. He would go to the secondary planet first, identify himself and his ship, then continue on to Earth. The Sakura broadcasted in 10 million miles off New Copenhagen. The moment the ship cleared the anomaly, Captain Takahashi ordered his engineers to start recharging the broadcast generator, a preventive measure. Takahashi, Yamashiro, and Commander Suzuki Hideki stood around the map table staring into a three-dimensional holographic map, looking for signs of ships patrolling the area. They saw no movement, but their radar found several wrecks orbiting the planet. They tried to signal the planet, but received no response.
Perhaps they have abandoned the planet.
Maybe so. As I understand it, the cities were destroyed during the war with the aliens.
Should we proceed to Earth?
No. Send down a transport. There may yet be people on this planet.
If there are people on New Copenhagen, then they are hiding. We've tried to signal them on every frequency, military and civilian. They should have a robot transponder on this planet at the very least.
New Copenhagen was the Unified Authority's final colony. The Linear Committee would not abandon its final colony without a fight. If they have abandoned the planet, I want to know why. We may be defending a people who are already extinct.
He gave his son-in-law a sympathetic gaze as he said this, but Takahashi looked away.
Admiral, do you think the aliens have attacked Earth?
It's been 3 years since we have had contact with Earth. Any one of a million fates may have befallen it during our absence. History may have left us behind. Perhaps the known laws of time do not apply in Bodhi's galaxy. By our clock, we have been absent for 3 years, but 1,000 centuries may have passed on Earth.
Do you really think that is possible?
Possible? Anything is possible. Perhaps we only saw the first wave of a more massive assault before we set off for the galaxy.
Time passed as the Sakura approached New Copenhagen. The mood on the bridge remained grim.
Admiral, do you want to send SEALs to search the planet?
Our transports will cover more territory from the sky.
Satellites are even faster.
Yamashiro began to brush off the suggestion as cowardice, then realized that what Takahashi had said was true.
Satellites. They would be faster still.
The transport deployed 3 satellites and returned to the ship. Fearing the worst, Yamashiro had the satellite feed sent directly to it. He sat alone in his office, reviewing a live video that confirmed the worst of his fears. When the Joint Chiefs had briefed him about his mission, they told Yamashiro that the aliens destroyed cities and left them in ruins. He had seen footage of soldiers and marines fighting battles in forests. General Alexander Smith, the head of the Joint Chiefs, complained that the aliens had knocked us back to the Stone Age. The New Copenhagen Yamashiro saw in the video feed was not in the Stone Age. It looked like a planet that would not support life. Where there had once been forests on this planet, the trees had all burned away, leaving fields of charred stumps and scorched earth. Yamashiro searched for leaves, moss, ferns, grass, and animals. He found no signs of life, not even around the rivers and lakes. He studied the ruined landscape for 15 minutes. Then he shut his eyes and pressed his fingers against his eyelids. He thought about the Onoda, the Kyoto, and the Yamato, reasoning that any weapon that could scald an entire planet could certainly melt a battleship into a lump of clay. Trying to repress the fear and anger he felt, he returned to the video feed and was hypnotized by the devastation.
Should we go to Earth?
Few of his sailors knew that they had returned to their home galaxy. Yamashiro decided to show the video feed to Takahashi and the Master Chief of the SEALs. They would decide together whether or not they should return to Earth.
Three ships broadcasted into New Copenhagen space, less than 1 million miles from the Sakura. The ships glowed. Captain Takahashi had never seen ships that glowed like these ships, and the Sakura's sensors could not identify them.
Can you hail them?
No, sir.
The ships were closing in at 39 million miles per hour. The fastest Unified Authority ships Takahashi had ever seen had a maximum speed of 30 million miles per hour.
Prepare to broadcast.
And with that, the Sakura returned to Bode's galaxy. Location, Gobi. Galactic position, Perseus Arm. Astronomic location, Milky Way. The Unified Authority sent a spy ship into space near Gobi. The ship dropped a communications satellite and broadcast it out. The satellite carried a video feed that the Unifieds wanted us to see. A warning. It showed the fleet of ships we had patrolling Magus, a planet in the Sagittarius Arm. On the screen, the ships and the planet are plainly visible. A pair of mile-wide disks, the Magus broadcast station, floats in a distant corner of the screen. The station blends into the vastness of space, though an occasional flare in its electrical field gives its position away. Made up of ships from the Sagittarius inner and central fleets, the fleet patrolling Magus includes one fighter carrier, 7 battleships, and a fringe of destroyers, cruisers, and frigates. The ships sit in a loose cluster, the smaller ships toward the edge, and the fighter carrier in the center. The first two anomalies appear between the ships and the broadcast station. They look like budding flowers made out of electricity. Unified Authority battleships emerge from the anomalies. The shields protecting the UA ships glow the color of a fading sun. The hulls of the ships are sharp and sleek. They seem to slice through space as they approach the patrol. Our carrier launches her fighters. Our battleships fire torpedoes and particle beams. Our destroyers fall into place, flanking the intruders, allowing our ships to hit the enemy from every angle. In past battles, the Unified Authority's new shield technology has been strong, but not impenetrable. Hit it with a sufficient amount of strength, and it will break down. In a prolonged fight, our fleet has more than enough torpedoes to break through the shields. A third UA battleship broadcasts in on the other side of our fleet, between our ships and the planet. The enemy approaches our ships like wolves attacking a flock. They are predators, unafraid, ready to kill. If our ships had broken formation and run, some of them would have made it to the safety of the broadcast zone. The UA ships are self-broadcasting. They cannot follow ours into the broadcast zone without being destroyed. With his fighters launched, however, the captain of the carrier cannot cut and run, so our battleships slowly shift into position, forming a border around the carrier. The Unifieds have a new toy that they want us to see. Upgraded torpedoes. As the UA ships muscle their way into our formation, they fire torpedoes at our battleships. Instead of stressing the shields, these new torpedoes obliterate them. They strike the clear electric panes that form our ship's shields and explode in a glittering flash of red and yellow and gray. The shields light up like glass reflecting bright sunlight. Then they vanish. Admiral Leota, the newly appointed commander-in-chief of the Enlisted Man's Empire, froze the video as a torpedo struck the forward shield of the fighter carrier. He pointed to the antennae that projected the shields.
Do you see what's happening here? Right here. Look at the antennae. Did you see how they caught fire and exploded? Did you see that? These new torpedoes make our shields overcharge. Now look at this. See here on the shields?
Fire smoldered where the torpedo had struck the shield of a battleship. It wasn't a flaming fire, not the kind of fire that gets extinguished by the vacuum of space. This looked like phosphorus, as if the chemical had somehow attached itself to the shield and fed on itself.
One hit. One hit. All they needed was one specking torpedo to knock out our shields. There's no telling what other damage it did inside the ship.
He started the video feed rolling again, this time closing in on one of the Unified Authority battleships as it attacked. The UA ship fires a second torpedo, striking our unshielded carrier just below the bridge. The armor gives way immediately. Flames burst out of the ruptured hull and disappear. As the disintegration spreads along the hull, armored tiles break off like scales, and the ship seems to decompose before us. Admiral Leota stopped the feed.
It appears they're using 2 kinds of torpedoes, one for shields and one for ships.
Shaped like a knife,
The Unified Authority's new battleships have torpedo arrays on either side of their hulls. The ship charges in, hitting multiple targets, leaving them moldering in her wake. Hoping to stop the inevitable, our fighters swarm the enemy battleship. Their cannons and rockets peck at the shields, causing no damage. With our fighters pecking uselessly at her shields, the first of the UA battleships fires a torpedo at the fighter carrier. The forward shield lights up. It shimmers and erases as a second torpedo strikes the carrier across her bow. The UA ship fires one final torpedo, which erases any chance of survivors. When that last torpedo strikes, it breaks the fighter carrier in half. We all sat in silence for several seconds after the feed ended.
Damn.
We did not lose every ship in that encounter. After they destroyed the fighter carrier, the Unifieds allowed our remaining ships to escape.
What were the damages? How many specking ships did we lose?
Leota looked at Admiral Wallace, then glanced at his notes.
9 ships, 7 fighters.
Only 7 fighters?
We're in contact with the other fighters. As soon as we're sure the coast is clear, we'll send a carrier out to retrieve them.
Admiral, who shot the video?
Unknown. We should assume the Unified sent a spy ship to record the battle.
The sons of bitches sent a spy ship to record a specking massacre. What a nightmare. What a specking nightmare.
Well, any suggestions?
It seems obvious.
Holman and I were still orbiting Gobi, still in the Perseus arm. Leota and Wallace appeared through the holographic communications display.
What's obvious?
We don't need to fight them. They're not trying to take our planets from us. They want their barges back, but they can't fire at the barges because they need them as much as we do. You with me so far?
So they want their barges back, so what?
Don't you get it, sir? They can't just take the barges.
What do you mean they can't take the barges? We can't defend our ships against those torpedoes.
Admiral, they can't use those torpedoes on the barges. They need the barges as much as we do. If they break the barges, everybody dies. Even if they board the barges, where are they gonna take them?
They'll specking take them back to Earth.
How? Those barges don't have broadcast engines. They would need our broadcast stations to take the barges back to Earth.
Shit!
You're right. They can't take the barges without our help. They'd need us to surrender so that they can use the broadcast network.
That's why they're trying to scare us. That's why they're using the killer torpedoes. They're trying to scare us into submission. They want us to surrender the barges and the broadcast network without a fight.
Assuming you're right, what does that get us?
We don't need to fight. They won't attack our ships if they don't get anything for their trouble. They want us to stand and fight because they know they won't lose. If we run and take the barges with us, they can't come after us if we enter a broadcast zone.
That's your strategy? That's your observation? You think we should just run away? I'm sorry, I shouldn't have let us.
You have a better idea.
Captain, I think you'd better...
Admiral, if we keep our ships close enough to the broadcast zones, the Unifieds won't be able to attack them.
I'm not sure that a goddamn specking mass retreat counts as a strategy, Admiral. But the kid's got a point.
What point? What is his point?
If we keep our ships just outside the broadcast zones and run when the Unifieds arrive, they won't be able to hit us.
That's a coward's way of running a navy.
But it will work. How about you, Harris? You're the big, hairy-chested fighting machine. How do you feel about ducking for cover every time we see the Unifieds?
Works for me. I think it's an ingenious strategy.
An ingenious strategy. Well, if we're going to employ the captain's ingenious strategy from here on out, let's just hope the Unifieds don't turn up while we're evacuating Bangalore.
Bangalore was the next planet slated by the Avatari for execution. We had already begun evacuating it.
I'll tell you what, we'll leave a hell of a lot of people to fry if we run away at Bangalore. God, I hope they do not attack us at Bangalore.
If it comes to a choice between evacuating Bangalore or evacuating all of our other planets, we'll need to abandon Bangalore, Admiral.
Do you think the Unifieds know that Bangalore is next?
They know.
They got their information from the same source we got ours. From the virtual ghosts of the late great scientists William Sweetwater and Arthur Breeze. What took a couple of hours on Gobi had already taken an entire day on Bangalore, and the end was not in sight. Gobi had a population of under 500,000. Bangalore had 8 million residents. It took 2 barges to evacuate Gobi.
If we filled all 25 barges to capacity on the first round, we'd still need to send some of them for a second pass. And it wasn't just a question of loading the people onto the barges. Once we loaded them on, we carted them to Providence Cree, where we had to transport them down to the planet. Offloading passengers went more quickly than loading them, but not quickly enough. 7 hours into the evacuation, Admiral Leota flew to Bangalore to run the show himself. He began his salvage operation by sending thousands of officers down to the planet and telling them that he would not allow them back on their ships until the evacuation was complete. The ground operation progressed slowly, with sailors and marines herding entire towns into spaceports and makeshift way stations. Transports ran on tight schedules. Loading and unloading times were cut in half, and the pace of the rescue picked up. Sadly, no one realized that they needed to stage the evacuation in waves. The cluster spec that once slowed operations on the ground simply shifted to a cluster spec that tied up operations on the barges. I traveled down to Bangalore to inspect the evacuation and crack a few skulls. I started the trip to Bangalore in the luxurious main cabin of my personal command shuttle, a remnant from happier days. A minute after we cleared the Bolivar, I entered the cramped cockpit. My pilot, Lieutenant Nobles, and I had developed a friendship. I felt an obligation to go chat with him.
Do you think they're out there?
Who? The Unifieds? They've got eyes out there. You can count on it.
What do you think the Unifieds will do when the aliens reach Earth? Think they'll ask us for help?
Well, they might. I think they'd rather kill us and take their barges back. If they can't, they'll probably ask for help.
Yeah, well, if Tobias Andropov asks me for a ride, I'll tell him to kiss my ass.
Andropov was the senior member of the Linear Committee, making him the most powerful politician in a mortally wounded republic. We entered the atmosphere, the shuttle's sleek profile piercing the bubble with very little resistance.
I heard they wanted to set up undersea cities.
Before becoming a Unified Authority signee, the French government had launched an undersea mining and colonization program called the Cousteau Oceanic Exploration Program. They hoped to form an alliance that would rival the UA's Space Exploration Alliance, but only Tahiti signed on.
I heard that too.
Think they can go deep enough?
Depth isn't the problem. Size is the problem. Their undersea cities are too specking small.
That's funny. Now they know how it feels.
Nobles slowed us to a sluggish 300 miles per hour as we dropped toward the clouds. It was night. Moonlight made the clouds gray, and the ocean below us was black. Wherever I looked, I saw transports muscling their way through the sky, looking no more aerodynamic than bumblebees, and exceptionally clumsy at that.
Man, we really specked them over when we stole their barges.
They specked themselves.
We flew to the Bangalore Pangalactic Spaceport, the hub of the evacuation. Transports, which have skids instead of wheels, can land in tight spaces and on tiny platforms in sports stadiums and shopping centers. My shuttle had wheels. We needed a runway. The control tower cleared us, and Nobles set us down. The officers drove me to an Air Force base, where a small knot of Marines came out to greet me. We traded salutes and pleasantries. Admiral Leota had placed my Marines in charge of looking for food and dealing with looters.
How is the evacuation going?
Oh, it's a mess, sir. I don't know who came up with these evacuation plans, but we're finding looters on every street. It's a mess. General, these people are scared. We're herding them like cattle, and they're scared of us. They're even more scared we're going to leave them behind.
Will we get them all out?
It's going to be close, sir.
How about supplies? Do we have enough time to gather supplies?
We already gathered them. We've had teams out all day. We have the food and the medicine. All we need now is transports to lift the supplies out.
Where are the supplies?
Stacked up and ready at the spaceport.
Outstanding. So the supplies we need will be in neat stacks when they burn to dust.
But sir,
where is Admiral Leota?
I'm not sure, sir. He might be at Gandhi.
Back at the spaceport? Well, that's excellent. Let's go find him. You can show me the supplies when we get there.
I'd lost track of Ray Freeman since the last time we'd contacted Sweetwater. I ran into him as we were getting ready to leave the Air Force base. What are you doing here?
You listed me as a civilian advisor. I came here to advise.
Looks like these guys need all the advice they can get.
We don't have enough time to get everyone off planet.
Yeah, I know. I think it's time I relieve the officer in charge. I hear he's at the spaceport.
You mean Leota?
That's the man.
He left the planet.
Know where he went?
I can find him for you.
Ray Freeman. Welcome to the Praetorian Guard.
I got the feeling Admiral Leota suspected me of having something to do with Admiral Jolly's untimely demise. Leota conducted his business via the holographic meeting device, holding daily summits and refusing to grant me a face-to-face interview. At least I was not alone in the conference room. Captain Morris Dempsey, the officer Leota placed in charge of evacuating Bangalore, sat to my left. Captain Jim Holman, the red-headed clone, sat to my right. Dempsey looked stressed. Holman looked like a man who didn't have a care in the world.
What is the status of the evacuation?
It's in progress, sir.
Is it running according to schedule?
We fell behind schedule at the start, sir, but things are looking up now.
Holman, who was pretending to take notes, lazily wrote bullshit on his notepad.
Glad to hear it.
Admiral Wallace seemed surprised by the report.
Will you be able to rescue the entire population?
Yes, sir, Admiral.
Really? Every man, woman, and child?
Yes, sir. We almost certainly will.
Well done, Dempsey.
How about supplies?
I need to get back to you on that one, Admiral. I'm not certain where we stand, sir.
So you're telling me, Captain, that we're evacuating millions of people, but we will not have food to feed them? Is that what you're telling me? Why the hell should we evacuate them? If they're going to die either way, we might as well leave them to burn on Bangalore, Captain. That way they'll die faster. Start pulling supplies, Dempsey. Do not leave Bangalore with an ounce less than 1 million tons of supplies. That is an order.
Sir, 0 hour is at 0800.
That was 3 hours away.
Son of a bitch. Then you'd better come up with something fast. Don't even try leaving that planet without the supplies, or I'll leave your ass there to burn.
Yes, sir. I'll do my best, sir.
No, don't do your best. I've already seen your best. Your best is what got us into this situation.
Admiral, what is happening with the rest of our fleet?
Nothing important.
That's funny. I heard the Unifieds attacked our ships in the Cygnus and Perseus arms. Maybe it's just me, but that sounds important.
We kicked their asses.
Is that so? I heard the Unifieds kicked our asses.
Specking lies.
Did we lose any ships? I knew the answer. We'd lost 15 ships, including 5 battleships and a fighter carrier.
Well, yes, we took losses.
Did we destroy any of their ships?
Damn straight we did. We destroyed 3 of their ships.
Somebody needed to teach Wallace the difference between winning and losing. He seemed to believe that winning a fight meant losing more ships. Admiral, we have 18 more planets to evacuate. We're in trouble on Bangalore, but that will just be the start of our problems if we can't find a permanent place to relocate evacuees.
How about Earth?
Be serious.
I'm being serious.
So am I. Now shut the spec up.
Admiral, we buy ourselves a reprieve by taking the Unifieds out of the equation. They have food to spare, space to spare, and their planet is the last one on the aliens' agenda.
We don't have time for this, Admiral. Right now we need to concentrate on getting people off Bangalore.
You want to know about Bangalore? I'll tell you about specking Bangalore. A lot of people are going to die on that goddamn rock. We're not going to pull any specking supplies in time. Your shit for brains evacuation plan failed, and now we're wasting our specking time trying to play catch-up. That's what is happening on Bangalore, Admiral.
Wallace, you are out of line.
Rattled, angry, and trying to regain control of a meeting that seemed to have left him behind, Admiral Leota turned to me.
Do we know which planet is next? Please, for God's sake, don't say it's Solomon.
But of course, it was Solomon. How did you know it was Solomon?
We had 5 ships patrolling Solomon. As of 2 hours ago, we lost contact with them.
Why didn't they broadcast out?
That's the problem with Solomon. The broadcast station is too far from the planet. It's the same setup as Earth with the Mars broadcast station. Depending on where the planet is in its orbit, the trip can take 10 hours. I've put a lot of thought into this one, Harris. We're not going to evacuate Solomon. It's not worth the risk.
What do you mean by not going to evacuate?
I mean that we are not going to sacrifice ships and men on a mission that cannot possibly succeed. Harris, the Solomon broadcast station is currently 63 million miles from Solomon. It would take 2 hours to cover that space in our fastest ships. Those barges don't even fly 5 million an hour. It would take them a full day just to fly to the planet and back. If you think we're having trouble getting people off Bangalore, just try figuring out the logistics for Solomon.
So you're not even going to warn them?
What could we accomplish by warning them?
Well, they can find caves and tunnels and basements. They can go underground.
That's not what would happen. If you tell those people that their planet is going to explode, you get riots and chaos. Some people might survive.
There are 7 million people on Solomon. You make the call, Harris. Maybe we should lift the kids from the planet. That's the humanitarian move, yes? We rescue the children, then transfer them across the galaxy as a shipload of orphans. Of course, we could take the pragmatic approach. Save the scientists, the politicians, the people with something to contribute. Or we could be practical. We can save everyone on one of the continents. Maybe even an entire hemisphere.
Get specked. I knew the son of a bitch was right. He was also an asshole. We need to warn those people. We owe him that much.
You warned Terrano. How did it work out?
Solomon is a lost cause, General. It's time you accept that.
Earth date, November 25, AD 2517. Location, Solar System A361. Galactic position, Solar System A361. Astronomic location, Bodas Galaxy. It was as if every man on the bridge had forgotten to breathe. Takahashi felt it. Looking over at Yamashiro, he saw that his father-in-law felt it too. Re-entering the solar system felt like climbing into an open grave. They were tempting fate. The aliens had destroyed 3 battleships in this solar system, melting them from the inside out.
I've located the transport, sir.
That was a relief. Takahashi had half expected to find the melted shells of the 2 transports floating lost in space.
Tell the pilots we are on our way.
The Sakura had re-entered the minefield, and every sailor knew it. No one spoke unless there was an official reason. Takahashi had never seen a bridge so quiet for so long.
I want the broadcast engines charged and ready.
Takahashi spoke to Suzuki.
Yes, sir. It already has begun.
The Sakura did not have room for 2 more transports in her landing bays. Takahashi planned to create room for the stealth birds by jettisoning 2 standard-issue transports. He needed stealth transports for an experiment. When the aliens had destroyed the Onoda and her sister ships, they did not attack the transports. Maybe the aliens could not see through the transports' stealth shields. To test the theory, Takahashi planned to purge the oxygen from a stealth transport and send her out as a drone. If he could sneak stealth transports past the aliens, maybe he could send them to their planet for an old-fashioned bombing run. Maybe. Moments after entering the solar system, Takahashi learned that the mission would fail. His chief navigator approached the table where he stood with Admiral Yamashiro and Commander Suzuki.
Captain, sir, the aliens have placed an ion shield around their planet.
The navigator pointed to a display showing a planet that looked like a ball bearing. Instead of clouds and continents, the planet's surface appeared to be sheathed in a white gold sleeve.
Thank you, Lieutenant. That will be all.
Yes, sir.
Takahashi looked back at the image of the planet. A gleaming white gold ball, surrounded by the luxuriant darkness of space. It looked like a gem, or possibly the eye of a demon. It looked both beautiful and evil.
They've sleeved themselves, just like they sleeved Shin Nippon.
The dice never break our way.
Captain, sir, we still need to rescue those pilots.
Rescue our pilots and fire our bombs. We proceed with our mission as we planned it.
He looked to his father-in-law for approval. Grim-faced as ever, Yamashiro met his gaze and gave him a single nod. When the Japanese fleet had first left for Bodas Galaxy, Yamashiro considered the seals expendable, maybe even disposable. He also believed he could locate the aliens and destroy their planet without needing the seals' services. After seeing 3 of his battleships destroyed, the Admiral no longer held either belief. Sitting in his stateroom, the lights dimmed so low he could not read from paper. He rubbed his temples, stared into a dark corner, and thought about the honored dead. He pictured Captain Miyamoto Genyo, whom he had come to regard as the last of the samurai. Yamashiro had admired Miyamoto more than any man he had ever known. He revered Miyamoto above even his own father. When the aliens had destroyed the Onoda, they destroyed a portion of Yamashiro's soul. Now that Miyamoto was gone, Yamashiro Yoshi had to divine his own philosophy of war. Under Miyamoto's tutelage, the Admiral had come to equate honor with death in battle. Now, having seen 3 battleships melt, he'd come to realize that there was no honor in a pointless death. He was not afraid of dying in battle, doing his duty even when it might cost him his life. Dying during the destruction of an abandoned base on a forgotten moon, though, that was pointless.
Yamashiro did not mind laying down his life invading the Avatari, and he would willingly ask every man and woman under his command to make the same sacrifice, if they had a chance of accomplishing their mission. If death took on meaning in battle, Yamashiro realized he had dishonored the noble dead by assigning every dangerous detail to the seals. He admired the seals. He respected their courage. He would not deny the seals their chance to die with honor. Nor would he deny his sailors that opportunity, men and women alike. The flashing light on Yamashiro's communications console interrupted the darkness and his thoughts.
Moshi Moshi?
Admiral.
What do you need, Captain?
The Master Chief of the Seals came to see me.
So I understand.
He says he has men who have been trained to pilot a transport.
Yes. He left a similar message with my assistant.
He offered to have his men fly a mission to A361B. Admiral, we don't need to risk our men.
Hiro, the Seals are our men.
Takahashi did not argue the point.
Tell Master Chief Oliver that his offer is appreciated, but that on this mission, I would prefer to send Japanese.
The crew walked up the ramp and into the kettle, no one speaking. An even dozen stealth infiltration pods lay on the deck of the kettle, strapped along the wall, their polished tops reflecting the light from the technicians' helmets. The pilot felt hollow inside. He felt scared. This was the part of the mission that worried him most, thinking he might reveal the fear he so wanted to hide. It was not the pilot's first mission. He'd flown Ilyich and his team to A361F, the fatal mission.
Secure the cargo.
The pilot went up to the cockpit. Now that the hatch was sealed, and he had entered his cockpit, the pilot found the resolve that would enable him to carry out his duty.
Flight Control, this is Transport One.
He went through the launch steps as if they were the five stages of death. He contacted the pilot of the second transport to make sure his ship was ready. Flying at its top speed of 30 million miles per hour, the Sakura ferried the transport to a delivery point approximately 3 million miles off A361B. That would leave the transports with a long, slow flight, but that was how it had to be. If they launched too close to A361B, the aliens would surely spot the Sakura.
Ship's in position!
The pilot purged the air out of the kettle and launched. One of the technicians called from the kettle.
If the aliens made the air in the Onoda 9,000 degrees, what's going to stop them from igniting the air in our helmets? Probably it's not enough air. They have ignored our helmets so far. They had better targets last time. No one forced you to take this mission. Are you kidding? This is my ticket to the Yasukuni Shrine before the seals fill it up.
The Yasukuni Shrine was a Shinto temple in old Japan that served as a designated resting place for the spirits of soldiers and heroes. Tradition had it that the spirits of the kamikaze went to Yasukuni.
This is not a kamikaze mission. Yamashiro would have given a farewell if it were. He should have given us a farewell. You should tell him that when we return.
Both transports' crews were made up of lieutenants. Captain Takahashi had decided that this mission was too important for enlisted men and too likely to fail to dump in the lap of a senior officer. It was going to be a long mission. They had 6 million miles to travel in a transport with a top speed of 200,000 miles per hour. Location: Solomon. Galactic position: Norma Arm. Astronomic location: Milky Way. Leota pulled the Bolivar out from under my feet. He left strict orders with all of his ship's captains that they were forbidden to fly their ships to Solomon. As long as I traveled in ships belonging to the enlisted man's fleet, Solomon would remain out of reach. So I chose a ship that did not belong to the fleet. I took the spy ship. Technically speaking, my crew was AWOL. But I was the highest-ranking officer in the fleet and the head of the new Praetorian Guard. I'd pardon the infraction. It was a small crew. I hoped no one would notice.
Admiral Leota's gonna shit himself when he finds out we took this ship.
You're not thinking of backing out.
Not a chance. I just get a kick out of the idea of Leota shitting himself.
I liked Jim Holman. He was casual. He was relaxed. He was also easy to recognize with that red hair and beard. We could have broadcasted in within 100,000 miles of Solomon, but Holman brought us in beside the Solomon broadcast station.
Why exactly are we taking the scenic route?
Broadcasting in beside a working broadcast station provides good camouflage. If the Unifieds are out there, they'll detect the anomaly, but they won't see our ship. They'll think debris floated into the broadcast zone.
Clever.
Basic tactics. Besides, I'm not supposed to be here. If Admiral Leota knew I came with you, he'd throw me in the brig.
I appreciate the ride. I just wondered why we took the longer route. Why are you here?
Do you want the long answer or the short one?
Might as well give me the long answer. We got time to kill.
I have a personal stake in this trip. I'm transporting contraband.
You're smuggling contraband to a planet that's about to get scorched?
It's not really contraband, and I'm not smuggling it. And it's not going to the planet, exactly. General, I think you're gonna like this. Let's make a quick inspection of the forward cargo bay. I wish I could take credit for this. Scott Mars came up with the idea. You came to save lives. I'm here to end some.
When did you take up with Scott Mars?
When you made me captain of this ship. You know, General, I have to admit, I was surprised when you put Admiral Jolly in charge. He was a joke as an officer.
Yeah, he was a mistake.
And Curtis the Snake is more of a politician than an officer.
From what I understand, Leota is considering an early retirement.
No kidding. Early retirement, just like Admiral Jolly? Do you think he'll be killed by looters as well? Listen, here's why you shouldn't have put Leota in charge. He's not gonna run into looters. If he thinks he's due for an early retirement, he's gonna hide someplace safe where no one can touch him.
You don't have much respect for the man.
Not much. He'd have been a good senator if he wasn't a clone.
You mean for the Unifieds?
Yeah. A good man for Unified Authority politics.
We entered a cargo hold at the bow of the ship. Like the corridor outside, the room was dark. Most of the light in the hold came from the low glow of dials along a far wall. The light, by the way, was not the pale white that shone from the domes in the hall. In one part of the room, the light glowed red. In the other, the light glowed blue. This was a cargo hold. It should have sat empty except for crates and supplies. As my eyes adjusted to the dim lumens, I saw equipment built into the walls and deck.
This is why I volunteered for this mission. What do you think?
You didn't volunteer. I asked you.
Okay, this is why I agreed to come. That's kind of like volunteering. So what do you think?
I don't know what I'm looking at.
It's a torpedo room.
Mars built a torpedo room in a spy ship? What, those skinny things are torpedo tubes? They look more like pea shooters.
Senior Chief, can you show General Harris the pills?
Aye, aye, sir.
The Senior Chief Petty Officer spun around and headed toward the twin chrome and iron tubes.
You're right about the tubes. They are small. Standard tubes have a 32-inch bore. These tubes have an 8-inch bore.
You're firing quarter-sized torpedoes?
Don't blame me. I didn't design them.
But this was Mars' idea?
He didn't make the torpedoes. He just installed the tubes. Oh, and he told me where to find the torpedoes.
Nestled in the nearest tube, as snug as a bullet in the chamber of a gun, sat a 3-foot-long torpedo with red lights etched along its shaft. The glow from the torpedo was the lurid color of blood oranges, and the lights along the tube matched the color precisely. The tube beside it held a torpedo that glowed ice blue. The senior chief removed the torpedo from the blue tube and brought it to me so that I could have a closer look. As I inspected the torpedo, I realized that it wasn't marked with blue lights. The glow came from the inside. The outside of the torpedo was made of some kind of thick polymer through which the inner core shone. The dark areas along that shaft were labels of some sort. What is this?
These are the torpedoes. We salvaged them from the battleships.
What battleships?
You know, Mars.
Lieutenant Mars?
The planet Mars.
And then I understood. I understood everything in a flash that left me dizzy. It was like waking up from a midday nap. We had destroyed several UA battleships when we stole the barges. Those battleships might well have been loaded with the torpedoes that could destroy our ships with a single shot.
These are the killer torpedoes.
The very ones. If we've got it right, the blue ones dissolve shields. We call them shield busters. The red ones pack the punch.
How can you tell?
The red ones are nuclear tipped.
How many of these things did you recover?
36 of each.
36? That could be enough to finish off their entire fleet. Last I heard, they didn't have 36 capital ships left in their navy.
an invisible ship armed with shield-buster torpedoes. The Unifieds would not know danger was near until it was too late for them to protect themselves. Have you run a test fire?
Like I said, that's why we're here. That's why I volunteered for this mission. I'm here to test the new weapon system.
Jim Holman wasn't the only person who had volunteered for the mission. Ray Freeman had come as well. Since Holman did not allow civilians on his bridge, Freeman waited for me in the third landing bay. I found him in a transport, sitting by himself in the unlit cockpit. Like any trained sniper, he was immune to boredom.
Did you hear about the torpedoes?
This is a spy ship. It doesn't carry torpedoes.
This one does.
I told him about all the modifications and the pills.
Is that why we broadcasted it in so far from the planet?
Holman says he did that for camouflage. He broadcasted in near the broadcast zone so the Unifieds would mistake our anomaly for debris.
Uh-huh. And what happens if we run into UA ships?
It sounds like he's thought of everything. If it comes to a battle with one-hit-kill torpedoes, the invisible ship wins.
What if Solomon is like Terrano? What if they won't listen to us?
Terrano was a neutral planet. Solomon is part of the Enlisted Man's Empire. There was no reasoning with Dr. O. He saw us as an enemy.
Would you believe a clone and a mercenary if they told you to evacuate your planet?
We'll do what we can.
It's in God's hands after that.
Yeah, God's hands.
You don't believe in God. You used to.
I used to believe that God was a metaphor for government. Now I'm a heretic. I don't believe in governments.
And God?
If there is a God, why did he create the Avatari? Why is he letting them kill entire populations?
Freeman didn't answer.
I find it pretty specking hard to believe that there's a God out there who loves everybody, but he sends them to hell if they don't believe in him.
Maybe he doesn't send them to hell. Maybe he's just like us, running from one planet to the next, trying to save as many people as he can from a disaster that's already occurred.
How about clones? Do you think he's trying to save clones?
I don't believe in souls.
You don't believe in souls?
I don't know if there's a life after this one, but if there is, I think that everyone gets a part of it. And you're a walking, breathing man, Harris, and that makes you just like everyone else.
So is God the reason you're here? Is God the reason you're risking your life?
Freeman only shrugged. The man was a Sphinx.